On today's Fresh Air, we take a look back at 2006. Our critic at large, John Powers, has put together a list of the cultural defining moments of the year. I'll just say that both Borat and Stephen Colbert make the list. Our rock critic Ken Tucker will be here with his picks for the year's best music. One person appears on both Ken and John's list, but I'm not going to tell you who. And later in the show, our TV critic David Bianculli has some gift suggestions, DVD box sets of classic and recent TV series. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. At the end of each year, our critics put together their 10 best lists. In fact, our rock critic, Ken Tucker, will be here with his list later in the show. This year, we've added a new list. We asked our critic at large, John Powers, to come up with the cultural defining moments of the year. John is film critic for Vogue and used to write a media column for LA Weekly. Well, hi, John. Happy holidays. You know, before we start talking about your choices for the defining cultural moments of the year, let's kind of spell out what the rules of the game are. How did you choose these moments? What are your criteria?
Yes. Well, in looking for these moments, I was looking for moments that either clearly changed the culture, sometimes actually affecting elections, or to just the kind of things that people spent a lot of time talking about this year, which kind of entered the culture and sort of had people buzzing.
Why is the Borat movie on your list?
Well, at one level, probably Borat is the great zeitgeist movie of the year. And in fact, it's a great challenge to people because you never quite know what to do with it. On the one hand, it's extremely funny, and almost everybody who sees it thinks it's really funny. On the other hand, a lot of people think it's kind of mean and nasty, and it makes fun of the people in the movie. And in fact, what's great about Borat is it's a movie that calls into question all sorts of things. On the one hand, it has a satirical thrust about racism and anti-Semitism. On another hand, it actually just shows this hilarious, charming, ignorant guy pretending to be who is a Kazakhstani supposedly, but who's actually just a creation, bursting into people's homes and treating them, in some cases, badly. And we don't quite know how to react to that. I mean, for a long time, I've complained that our comedy hasn't really been very edgy, that people are doing things that are safe. Whereas what's great about Borat is that you can laugh at it and maybe not even like yourself for laughing at it. Because, in fact, it's one of those things that pushes comedy in a direction, you know, farther than what we normally see.
Well, let's hear a scene from the movie. And here, you know, Borat, played by Sacha Baron Cohen, is talking to a couple of feminists.
So what that means is this feminism?
It's the theory that women should be equal to men in matters economic,
now,
social,
you are laughing.
Yeah.
That is the problem.
Do you think a woman should be educated?
Definitely.
But is it not a problem that a woman have a smaller brain than a man?
That is wrong.
But the government scientist, Dr. Yamak, have proved it is size of squirrel.
He's wrong.
Give me a smile, baby. Why angry face?
Well, what you're saying is very demeaning. Do you know the word demeaning?
No.
You know, I personally think Sacha Baron Cohen is really like a genius when it comes to persona. And Stephen Colbert has created an incredible persona, too, as a conservative pundit on his show, The Colbert Report. And Stephen Colbert at the White House press corps dinner has made it to your list of defining cultural moments of the year. Why did this speech make it on the list?
Well, it became a kind of a national talking point, because here is a comedian talking at a White House thing to the president and to the media and saying things so radically out of tune with the kind of jokes that are normally made at such an event that within hours of him talking, the blogosphere was lit up. And in fact, people put the entire thing on the net. So almost everybody saw, you know, Stephen Colbert doing this thing where he both makes fun of the president and the media. I mean, here he is talking about reporters.
But listen, let's review the rules. Here's how it works. The president makes decisions. He's the decider. The press secretary announces those decisions, and you people of the press type those decisions down. Make, announce, type. Just put them through a spell check and go home. Get to know your family again. Make love to your wife. Write that novel you got kicking around in your head. You know, the one about the intrepid Washington reporter with the courage to stand up to the administration? You know, fiction.
Well, why did you choose that clip to play for us?
Well, I chose that clip for a couple of reasons. One, because it actually is a comedy kind of like Borat, which actually pushes things, because it was considered by many people to be a very rude thing to give such a speech insulting both the president and the people in the audience. But what I particularly thought was interesting about it was that the way the media now works is that the elite people of the media, and that's largely who would be sitting in the audience for that, are very much part of the same sort of social, cultural world in Washington as the people they're covering. And one thing I know from living there and actually having dealt with a lot of media people over the years and political people is that they take pride in being invited to those events. So Colbert is touching on one of their sorest points, which is that they, in fact, don't really cover politics as honestly and as toughly as they could, because, in fact, they really are part of the social scene and the elite scene in Washington. And he's actually sort of jabbing them with that. And I can tell you that a lot of reporters didn't like it. It was amazing how many reporters claimed that his talk wasn't funny. Yet if you go on the internet and watch it, it's a very funny talk.
Well, another defining cultural moment on your list is the Muhammad cartoons, the cartoons that satirized the Prophet Muhammad and sparked riots in various parts of the world. And what questions do those cartoons and the response raise for you that bring them to your list of defining cultural moments of the year?
Yes. Well, like Borat and Colbert, they once again raise the question of what's going too far. Are you allowed to say anything? Are you allowed to joke about anything? And now, clearly, in Islam, you're not supposed to show the Prophet. And, in fact, you're particularly not supposed to do cartoons making fun of the Prophet. You know, as a person who, you know, cherishes our Constitution, I think that everyone should absolutely be allowed to make such jokes, even if other people find them offensive. I think one has to accept the fact that in a free society, people can make these jokes. Now, did those cartoons strike me as funny? No. Did they strike me as being ill-advised? Yes. I mean, there are lots of jokes that one could make that one wouldn't make for all sorts of reasons. Nevertheless, the principle would stand that you should be allowed to make the jokes, at least in my opinion. And what you see is that as people get stronger and stronger in their feelings about what can and can't be said, I think we may be pushing toward an era where you're going to have greater and greater and maybe even more violent debates over what is the limit of permissible speech.
Mel Gibson and Michael Richards both really crossed a line this year, and that made news, and they're both on your list of defining cultural moments of the year. Mel Gibson for his anti-Semitic comment, and Michael Richards for using the N-word when talking to hecklers during his comedy act. Give us your take on these, John.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, the first thing about it is that it's amazing how much play you can get if you're a celebrity saying something really vile and stupid. You know, I remember watching TV during the full flowering of the Mel Gibson hoopla, and I was struck that this was during the war in Lebanon, where Hezbollah, an actively anti-Semitic group, was fighting against Israel, and that war was getting less coverage than the anti-Semitic slurs of one movie star in Malibu. So there's something strange in that. But in fact, I think what it touches on is two things. One, people sense that maybe a lot of this feeling exists below the surface in ways that we're not quite used to. So in fact, it's still more there than you think, which I think one reason why it gets so much play. I think the other thing is that whereas people like Borat and Stephen Colbert are fictional creations, the Mel Gibson we see or the Michael Richards we see, somehow we want to believe in probably their good publicity rather than their bad publicity. So suddenly, if Michael Richards is this way, does it affect how we feel about Kramer? If Mel Gibson actually is spewing anti-Semitism, does that affect how we perceive The Passion of the Christ, which, as you'll recall when it came out, inspired some controversy about whether or not the film itself was anti-Semitic? It certainly seems to change our sense of that film a little bit to know that when drunk, Mel Gibson will start saying that Jews are starting all the world's wars.
Now, Senator George Allen used the word macaca, and that helped kill his Senate reelection campaign. So before we talk about why that's on your list of defining cultural moments, let's hear the clip of what he said.
My friends, we're going to run this campaign on positive, constructive ideas. And it's important that we motivate and inspire people for something. This fellow here over here with the yellow shirt, macaca, or whatever his name is, he's with my opponent. He's following us around everywhere. And it's just great. We're going to places all over Virginia. And he's having it on film, and it's great to have you here. And you show it to your opponent because he's never been there and probably will never come. So it's good for you. Rather than living inside the Beltway, or his opponent actually right now is with a bunch of Hollywood movie moguls. We care about fact, not fiction. So welcome. Let's give a welcome to Macaca here. Welcome to America and the real world of Virginia.
Well, that clip, which ended up everywhere, was first on YouTube. And is that why this is on your list, John?
Well, it's partly that. You know, I mean, partly it has a huge implication because, you know, George Allen, you know, probably in the course of that 1 minute went from being a potential presidential candidate in 2008 to being a person who lost his Senate seat, I think largely because of the kind of snowball effect of this. And in fact, the snowball effect was caused because this clip appeared on YouTube. And in fact, in the way that it appears, when you look at it, it's as though, because the guy he's talking to is holding the camera, it's as though Allen is talking to us and slightly ridiculing us for not being proper Americans. At the end of a speech that, or actually of a snippet, where he begins by saying, let's talk about positive, constructive ideas, and ends up making fun of a guy for not being an American when, in fact, the guy's an American. And so, like, as a piece of film, it's hard to imagine a more devastating 1 minute. But what's interesting to me about it is that 5 years ago, that devastating 1 minute probably wouldn't have been seen by anybody. But within a day of that 1 minute occurring, it was on YouTube, and hundreds of thousands of people were seeing it. And after that, the TV networks had to run it because, in fact, it was such a famous piece of footage.
Well, the year that YouTube really became this big phenomenon is also a year when newspapers were sold, reporters were laid off, budgets at newspapers were cut. How does that figure into your defining cultural moments of the year?
Yes, well, I think that you can't fail to notice that even as there's an explosion of the power of things like YouTube, that all the traditional media are really struggling. On the one hand, you have the newspapers cutting back lots and lots of jobs. They're terrified that they won't last into the, you know, last 10 years. You know, that a handful of papers might survive, but there's a real panic. And what that means, among other things, is that not only are they laying people off, that newspapers are trying to become more net friendly. You know, they have to adjust to a world that's a lot faster. It seems incredibly slow if you're a newspaper to have to wait until the entire next day when, in fact, we're not even living in a world where people get their news from the evening news. They're getting their news from what's happening at this exact moment. And so the newspapers are in a tremendous state of panic, and you can see it financially. Even though a lot of them are making big profits, they don't think their profits are going to last. And that matches up very nicely with the explosion of things like YouTube.
We're talking with our critic at large, John Powers. We'll hear what else is on his list of the cultural defining moments of the year after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is our critic at large, John Powers. He's put together a list of the cultural defining moments of the year. This is a year when theatrical releases of documentaries continue to be very popular, and a documentary that's made it to your list of cultural moments of the year is the Al Gore documentary about global warming.
Yes, I think what you do see happening is as some of the traditional forms of sort of nonfiction coverage tend to dwindle, like newspapers, that the work of those is being done by lots of places. And one of them is in the current explosion of documentaries. I mean, the Al Gore documentary, I think, marked not only was a huge financial success, but it probably marked a transformative moment in the way people think about the whole question of global warming. You know, lots of other stuff was going on at the same time. You actually had, you know, best-selling books that were on the subject. You actually had people, you know, in the evangelical Christian community debating global warming in a way that they hadn't been doing 2 years. But if you had to choose something that somehow captured that zeitgeist moment where all of a sudden everybody thought, you know, global warming's pretty serious, it's the Al Gore film, An Inconvenient Truth. You know, as a film, I don't think it's altogether great. I mean, partly because there's a little bit of Al Gore running for president, well, not quite running for president. But the speech he gives, or the little lecture he gives about global warming, you know, is very much a model of its kind.
Are there other documentaries that have made it to your list?
Well, I think the other documentary, which is actually a television documentary, but that I do think is should be mentioned, is the Spike Lee film, the 4 hours called When the Levees Broke.
What do you think that film brings? It's about Hurricane Katrina and its aftermath.
About Hurricane Katrina.
Yeah, what do you think the film brings that the day-to-day coverage as the hurricane was happening did not?
Well, I think that what it captured was the people who were caught in it. Somehow, in the course of day-to-day coverage, even though the television was doing a full court press on it, they could never really step back enough and let people just talk about what happened to them. Plus, even though the networks did go back, you never really got the sense of talking to somebody for 30 or 40 minutes. Whereas a lot of the characters in the Spike Lee documentary, because it wasn't 400 people, but maybe 20 or 25 people, they seemed to exist as people. And you felt the weight of what happened to them far more profoundly. And there was an entire range of people that he chose from the most destitute people in Ward 9 to very well-off people to the TV actor Wendell Pierce to jazz musicians. And it gave you a sense both of what the city meant, but how it was lived and experienced as a calamity when the levees broke.
It's hard for books to keep up with the news. But this year, there were a few books about, a bunch of books about the war in Iraq that really helped shape the conversation, shape the debate about Iraq. Which of those books are on your list?
Well, I think, probably the most important of these books was the Bob Woodward book, State of Denial. I think it's probably not the best of the books. I think Thomas Rick's Fiasco was probably a better book about what happened in Iraq. But what I think happened with State of Denial was that you have this guy who routinely writes best-selling books about what's going on in Washington. You have Bob Woodward is sort of the gold standard for best-selling journalistic books about Washington. And he'd written two books that many people thought were very, very supportive of the Bush administration. Suddenly, this summer, he came out with a book which, in fact, suggested that the entire administration, including the president, was in a state of denial about the calamity that Iraq had become. Thomas Rick's book examined more the goings-on in Iraq and suggested that it was a fiasco, as his title had it. But what happened was you got these books together. All these books seemed to be coming out at the same time. And this was coming out just at the point where every day you seem to see on the news that another 40 people had been blown up in Baghdad. So these books, which were saying things that hadn't been said by such respected people before in quite the same way, came out at just the moment where I think a huge part of the population began to think maybe these things really are a mess in Iraq in a way we hadn't fully realized. And then these books filled in the blanks and explained how that happened. And there are more and more of these books. There's a new one out called In the Green Zone by yet another Washington Post reporter, filled with fascinating things about how they staffed the people who were going into the Green Zone in Baghdad. And when you put it all together, suddenly it was as though something that had been slightly out of focus came into sharp focus. And the leading edge of that was probably the Bob Woodward book.
Barack Obama's new book made it to number one on the nonfiction bestseller list, and that book is on your list of defining cultural moments of the year. Why?
I think because Obama, on the one hand, represents, to many people's minds, something new, and yet people aren't quite sure what it means. So he's a guy, in a way, whose stardom has run ahead of our sense of who he actually is. And I think that's revealed by the fact that his a nonfiction book would make it of that kind, about policy in many cases, would actually make it to the top of the bestseller list. I mean, he is clearly the star of the moment. And if you're looking at this year's zeitgeist, the idea that Hillary Clinton 6 months ago was thought to be the juggernaut in the Democratic Party, and as soon as Obama began entering in, someone like Evan Bayh would drop out. Because if it's possible that Obama will run, he seems to be the magical, charismatic rock star figure. And it shows not only something about him, but about how I think the culture, American culture, needs to have such figures. We're always looking for the person who's big and exciting, who is the person of the moment. And clearly, Barack Obama is the person of this moment. The interesting thing will be to see whether he sustains that. He's certainly gifted enough to do it. But will people get tired of him? Because, in fact, you can easily develop Obama fatigue, I think. But at the moment, he is the big story. It is impossible to avoid Barack Obama if you open a newspaper or turn on a TV set. I mean, he was there on Monday Night Football the other night.
We'll hear the rest of John Power's list of the cultural defining moments of the year in the second half of the show. John is our critic at large and film critic for Vogue. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Oh, the weather outside is frightful, but the fire's so delightful. And since we've no place to go, let it snow, let it snow, let it snow. It doesn't show signs of stopping. I brought some corn for popping and turn the lights way down low. Let it snow, let it snow, let it snow. When we finally kiss goodnight, how I'll hate going out in a storm. And if you really hold me tight, all the way home I'll be warm. The fire is slowly dying, and my dear, we're still goodbying. Long as you love me so, let it snow, let it snow, let it snow.
Support for NPR comes from Universal Pictures, presenting The Good Shepherd, starring Matt Damon, Angelina Jolie, and Robert De Niro, in theaters Friday, directed by Robert De Niro. And from The Dial Press, publisher of Women's Letters and Letters of the Century, two anthologies by Lisa Grunwald and Stephen J. Adler. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, our rock critic Ken Tucker picks the best music of the year. Our TV critic David Bianculli has some gift suggestions, DVD collections of classic and recent TV shows, and critic at large John Powers completes his list of the cultural defining moments of the year. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with our critic at large, John Powers. He's put together a list of the cultural defining moments of the year. Let's see what's left on the list. One TV series has made it to your list of defining cultural moments of the year, and that's HBO's The Wire, which I've come to think of as the most despairing TV series I've ever seen, and surely one of the absolute best.
Yeah, it's a great show, and it, you know, it's been around three seasons before, but I think this is the year where somehow it got in the air that this was one of the all-time great TV shows. People had said it in the past, but this is the year where op-ed pages were talking about The Wire. And this was the year where people I know who hadn't watched it before bought the DVDs and watched the first three seasons. You know, that somehow it entered the, you know, entered at least the media imagination. It's not clear to me whether it actually has taken over with the public or taken off with the public. I think it's actually bigger with critics and media types than it is with the public. And I think one reason for that, Terry, is that it is despairing. You know, that it is so much bleaker than the average movie you see.
Mm-hmm.
It's so much bleaker than the average art movie that you see. Because like a lot of art movies are filled with existential despair or some sort of angst, whereas what's great about The Wire is that it systematically goes through many of the institutions of a city and shows what happens to the people working within them or who are supposed to be being treated or helped by them. And in virtually every case, the result is at best frustration and at worst some sort of ghastly death.
And also it doesn't romanticize the thug life.
It doesn't romanticize the thug life, but in fact, it does the fun thing for me, and I think it is one of the fun of the show, is it shows you how it works. I think one of the great aspects of the show is the procedural aspect of it, where you realize, oh, this is how a homicide squad works, where they're trying to cover up the fact that there's a body until next year so you can actually play with the statistics. Or it shows you how teachers are forced to teach things just to help in the exams. But it also then shows you out on the street how you have to learn to beat up little kids if they mouth off to you in order to get respect, because otherwise you won't get respect, and that can be a life or death thing there. You know, it doesn't romanticize it in any way, but interesting enough, it makes it seem like a business in some ways like any other, but a particularly brutal business and one that's getting worse and worse. You know, for those of us who've been watching since the first season, it's weird to realize that you feel slightly nostalgic for the unbelievably brutal drug dealers of the first series, because in fact, they weren't sociopaths. Whereas the current drug dealer boss, Marlowe, in the fourth season, seems like he might be a sociopath, because even other drug people think he kills you for no reason. He kills you because he thinks he might have a reason, and that's enough of a reason to kill you.
There's some terrific acting in The Wire, and it's especially wonderful because there's so many great roles for African-American actors, and I think African-American actors have been limited in the number of roles available to them, so this is like a real bonanza of every kind of character. You've got the cops and the political operatives and the teachers and the gangsters and the students and the parents. And should we hear a clip, John?
Oh, sure. That would be great. I think here's one of the key moments from the last season, where a cop or an ex-cop named Bunny Colvin has gone to prison, and what Bunny is doing is trying to convince the father in prison to let his son be free of the family so that he can actually learn and move on with his life rather than being drawn into the drug world.
Yeah, because the parents have been pressuring him to sell drugs.
Because it's the family business. That the father wants him to be a man and keep on with the business, and the mother wants him to be a man and make the money by staying in the drug business.
I mean, the West Side, we know. It's dead, man. You know, people in the game nowadays, I mean, it's a whole different breed. No code, no family, you know, and damn sure no respect. I mean, you send Naaman out on them corners now, giving them maybe 1-2 years before you down the morgue. And maybe, if you're lucky, up here with you.
Maybe, maybe not. That's the game.
I'm talking about Naaman here, Mr. Bryce. He's a lot of things, a lot of good things. I mean, before you know, he might surprise all of us given half a chance. But he ain't made for them corners, man. I mean, not like we were. That's why I come down here, because I gotta believe that you see it. Being who you are and all you've been through, you know your son.
That was Robert Wisdom as the former police major Howard Bunny Colvin. Well, John, let's get to your final defining cultural moment of the year, and that's Bob Dylan's latest record, which went to number one on the Billboard chart.
I think it's partly because it's a wonderful thing to have someone like Bob Dylan actually make it to number one after almost 40 years. That is itself an extraordinary thing. And for those of us who grew up with Dylan, it's exciting to think, hey, we were right all along. Even 40 years later, he can get to number one on the charts. But what it also shows, and this links to what we've been talking about earlier about the influence of new media, is that the people most likely these days to buy something as a CD are people who tend to be older, whereas the younger people will be downloading the music and getting it some other way that wouldn't actually affect the charts. So even as I'm thrilled that Bob Dylan had the number one thing, I realize that it probably doesn't mean he's the most popular. Certainly he doesn't mean today what he meant 40 years ago. I don't even think for people my age that hearing Bob Dylan now, I think, oh, wow, this man's radically altering my consciousness. And I remember thinking that when I was listening to him in the 1960s. But what it does do is it shows the kind of weird, interesting divides where the number one CD might not actually be the most popular piece of music out at the time.
Right. Well, John, what gave you the most pleasure this year in terms of books or movies or television, music?
Yes. Well, I think my favorite show of the year was The Wire, which I very much like. And I'm also a great fan of Deadwood, which is in some ways very much like The Wire in that it's a long overarching story about and struggles for power. One of the great surprise pleasures for me this year was the movie Casino Royale, because I grew up worshiping James Bond. I was just the right
because
age.
Because you're
to be,
so
I
like
I
him.
Exactly. It's a curse, Terry. I grew up, and when I was 11 years old, I wanted to be James Bond. And then what happened was I got older, and the series got lousier. So that, as I got older, I probably wouldn't have wanted to be James Bond anyway because I'd grown up and become an adult. But you watch these series of people who somehow seem to me like dressers mannequins. And this year they managed to capture, I think, some of the pleasure I used to get from an old James Bond movie. I mean, partly it was because James Bond wasn't flying around in outer space, but was just actually running along cranes, above the Earth maybe 100 feet. That was exciting to me. I thought Daniel Craig did something I never thought I would see happen in a James Bond movie, which is act. There was somebody actually acting in a James Bond movie, which is kind of a remarkable thing.
Well, John, it was great to talk with you. Thanks a lot for putting together this list of cultural moments for us. And I wish you happy holidays.
Yeah, happy holidays. Thanks for having me.
John Powers is Fresh Air's critic at large and film critic for Vogue.
Magnolia trees at night, sparkle and bright. Fields of cotton love, wintry white. When it's Christmas time in New Orleans. A barefoot choir and prayer fills the air. Mississippi Falls gathering there, 'cause it's Christmas time. Time in New Orleans. You'll see a Dixieland Santa Claus leading the band to a good old Creole beak. Golly, what a spirit! You can only hear it down on Basin Street. Your cares will disappear when you hear, hallelujah, St. Nicholas is here. When it's Christmas time in New Orleans. That's
Louis Armstrong. Coming up, rock critic Ken Tucker has his list of the year's best music. This is Fresh Air. Rock critic Ken Tucker hasn't compiled a conventional top 10 music list this year. In keeping with the increasingly fragmented multimedia world in which popular music is disseminated and heard, he's come up with a quick overview of the industry, along with his picks for some of the year's best music in all its genres and formats.
It isn't bad to know your limitations. That we know can come to good, but if you had to know your situation, I see no reason you should. You don't have to know and say if you're in the clear, it's on the down low. Don't you find it anything you hear? It's on the down low. Don't you mind it? Hold your head.
That was Nellie Mackay, one of the more original and idiosyncratic pop music artists to make an interesting album in 2006. In this case, a double album called Pretty Little Head. Like Mackay, who harkens back to Tin Pan Alley and occasionally uses hip-hop metrics as a singer-songwriter, other pop acts demonstrated what an a la carte menu pop music has become. Take, for example, one of the year's biggest sellers, Gnarls Barkley's Crazy. This semi-supergroup was formed by the Atlanta rapper CeeLo Green and the Baltimore-based DJ and producer Danger Mouse. Together, they made music that blended hip-hop beats with 60s soul music vocals and 70s funk rhythms.
I remember when I lost my mind. There was something so pleasant about that place. Even your emotions have an echo in so much space.
Year in which CD sales dropped 5%, and along with it, the notion of the album as many performers' primary mode of expression. Instead, many of us heard music in other ways, single songs downloaded onto computers and iPods, tunes plucked from any band that put up their profile on MySpace.com and uploaded a song to make you think you were part of an elite fan club. We trolled for music videos on YouTube.com. Or, heaven help us, we downloaded ringtones, little bits of songs to amuse yourself and impress or annoy others when your cell phone goes off. These were the surging revenue streams for all genres of music this year. Not that the album, conceived as a suite of songs meant to cohere as an aesthetic and sometimes narrative whole, completely disappeared. One of the best was my favorite combination hard rock emo album, My Chemical Romance's grandiose but grand, The Black Parade.
They're gonna clean up your looks with all the lies in the books to make a citizen out of you. Because 'cause they sleep with a gun and keep an eye on you, son, so they can watch all the things you do. Because the drugs never work, they're gonna give you a smirk, 'cause they got methods of keeping you clean. They're gonna rip up your heads, your aspirations to shreds, another cog in the murder machine. They say
it was a pretty weak year for mainstream pop, what with the unavoidable ascendance of American Idol both on television and on the record charts, and a rather lame year for hip-hop, in which the gangsters sounded ever more nasty and desperate, Jay-Z's much-buzzed-about comeback album dropped nearly 80% the second week of its release, and the rapper Nas entitled his album Hip-Hop is Dead. Thank goodness for Ghostface Killah's Fish Scale, my pick for hip-hop album of the year. On the other hand, it was a great year for country music. My favorite in a walk was Willie Nelson's You Don't Know Me, the songs of Cindy Walker.
Now I don't care if I'm not the first one you've kissed, just so I'll be the last. And I don't care if I'm not the first you've caressed. Darling, I'll never ask. Yesterday's gone, just love me from now on. Be true to me, forget about the past. For I don't care if I am not the first love you've known, just so I'll be the last.
If you were looking for country artists younger than Willie, James Hand, Bradley Walker, and the Dixie Chicks all put out first-rate records. If you're looking for country older than Willie, I highly recommend the two best reissues of any genre this year, both on Columbia Legacy. Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys' Legends of Country Music, four discs of swivel-hip country swing. And Johnny Cash at San Quentin, a two-CD, one-DVD collection of his rightfully legendary 1969 prison concert. Ultimately, it was possible to find good albums in every genre, from the funk rocker Citizen Cope to senior citizen Bob Dylan. And even Dylan did a commercial for iPod this year. You can also make him your own personal ringtone.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. You'll find his list on our website, freshair.npr.org.
Thunder on the mountain and as far as the moon, the ruckus in the alley and the sun will be here soon. Today's the day you're gonna grab my trombone blue. Well, it's hot stuff here and it's everywhere I go. I was thinking about Alicia Keys, couldn't keep them quiet when she was born in Hell's Kitchen. I was living down the line. I'm wondering where in the world Alicia Keys could be. I've been looking for her even clear through Tennessee. Feel like my soul is beginning to expand. Look into my heart and you will sort of understand. You brought me here, now you're trying to run me away. The writing on the wall, come read it, come see what it says.
Coming up, TV critic David Bianculli reviews some DVD box sets of TV shows that he recommends as holiday gifts. This is Fresh Air.
Mm-hmm.
TV critic David Bianculli has some suggestions for last-minute holiday gifts, DVD box sets of classic and recent TV series. He says all of the recommendations are exciting and excellent options, but he warns that some of them are quite expensive.
If you're still scrambling for last-minute holiday gifts, I might be able to come to the rescue. But only, in some cases, if you're willing to lift a hefty box and pay an equally hefty price. The new trend this season in box sets of television series on DVD is something that ought to be called the mega set. These aren't just single-season collections of TV shows. These are compilations of the whole enchilada, every episode from start to finish. In rare cases, these shows are offered on DVD for the first time. Most of the time, though, they're just repackaged versions of things already available. This means the repackaging, both the box it comes in and the extra material provided as a bonus, makes all the difference to someone already in possession of the original releases. Either way, if you're planning to give one of these megasets to someone who's just getting into the DVD game, or who would appreciate the upgrade, there are some great packages out there this year for TV lovers. The biggest ticket items among the TV mega boxes, coming in at a paycheck-devouring $300 each, are two NBC series: The West Wing, the complete series from Warner Brothers, and Homicide: Life on the Street, the complete series from A&E Home Video. The first two seasons of Aaron Sorkin's The West Wing, especially, are as good as TV gets, and this beautifully packaged set includes a bound script and newly written introduction by Sorkin, and lots of audio commentaries and featurettes with all involved. The Homicide set, coolly packaged as a scale model filing cabinet, includes something the individual season releases did not: the Law & Order crossover episodes. It also contains the concluding Homicide telemovie, and again, the acting, writing, and directing here are phenomenal. Almost as expensive, at $280 from HBO Home Video, is 6 Feet Under, the complete series, which comes packaged as a graveyard plot. The only real extras included here are the two soundtrack albums available elsewhere on CD, so this is a gift mostly for fans who loved the show but don't own the individual season releases. Dropping to the still-imposing $200 range, we have the comedy collections. Fox Home Entertainment's MASH, the Martinis and Medicine collection, is a treasure wrapped handsomely in army green burlap. All 11 seasons of the groundbreaking CBS sitcom are here. So is the original Robert Altman movie, and so many documentaries and extras that there's no way to fail to grasp just what made this show so different, so good, and so popular. Its final episode still remains, and always will remain, the most watched single episode in TV history. The final megaset I'm recommending is the easiest one of all. Not only is it one of the least expensive, at a mere $200, but none of its episodes has ever been released on DVD, so this is a gift that can be given without fear of duplication. It's the new Time Life collection called Get Smart, the Complete Series, and it's an utter delight. This mid-60s spy spoof was co-created by Mel Brooks and Buck Henry, both of whom provide new audio commentaries. Don Adams starred as Maxwell Smart, Secret Agent 86, and Barbara Feldon was his sultry partner, Agent 99. Every Mel Brooks fan will want this set, and every Austin Powers fan may be shocked by how many of Mike Myers' concepts Get Smart got to first. The set is packaged in a phone booth, fans of the series will know why, and contains almost as many catchphrases as laughs.
Okay, Carioca, stay right where you are. Or should I say the blaster?
Max!
Oh. Okay, drop it.
Sorry about that, 99.
Now, whoever you are, remove your hat.
So, you're still alive, Maxwell Smart. How interesting. Untemporary.
You might as well hand over that gun blaster, because this yacht happens to be surrounded by the 7th Fleet.
I find that hard to believe.
Would you believe the 6th Fleet?
I don't think so.
How about a school of angry flounder?
Get Smart was filmed single camera, and despite its laugh track, falls right in line with such modern or postmodern TV comedies as Arrested Development and Scrubs. Old-timers like myself who saw the originals on NBC will love Get Smart. But so, I suspect, will college-age kids who missed it by that much. Finally, for those on a tighter budget, but still TV and DVD inclined, I'll point out two brand new first season packages that are my favorite releases of the year. From Fox, finally, comes Saint Elsewhere Season 1, presenting the opening year of perhaps my favorite TV drama of all time. And from Universal Studio Home Entertainment is a real blast from the past, the complete, unedited first season of Saturday Night Live, packaged with original screen tests, a fancy booklet, and more catchphrases than, well, than Get Smart. If the person you're buying gifts for wouldn't like any of these options, my guess is they don't own a TV anyway.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, Jonathan Menhivar, and Joan Tui Westman. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics Edition of A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Cato Charitable Foundation, advancing environmental values and saluting all those who work to sustain our world. And from Universal Pictures, presenting The Good Shepherd, starring Matt Damon, Angelina Jolie, and Robert De Niro, in theaters Friday. Directed by Robert De Niro. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
We are dream girls, boys, we'll make it happy. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the director of the new film Dream Girls, Bill Condon. He also wrote the screenplay for the movie Chicago and wrote and directed Kinsey and Gods and Monsters. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.